Blog Talk Radio.
This is Chief for Yourself. Now, here's Gio.
Hi, welcome to Chief for Yourself. Glad you're with us today, wherever you happen to be in the world at this moment. A lot of us worry about money, earning it, spending it, saving it, but we don't think about the nature of money. Our guest today says you can follow your own unique financial plan that's guided by your deepest beliefs. Jonathan K. Dio is a Berkeley-based financial planner who also happens to be a Buddhist. He's the author of Mindful Money, Simple Practices for Reaching Your Financial Goals and Increasing Your Happiness Dividend. And I'm happy to have him with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Jonathan, my early years featured money lessons centered on fear and scarcity. Every day I was regaled with stories about the strangely named Great Depression, and I heard all of the cliches, things like money doesn't grow on trees, and what do I look like, Rockefeller. What kinds of money lessons or examples did you have growing up?
Yeah, I didn't grow up with those messages, but my parents grew up with those messages, and so they did share a lot of those messages with me. The overarching message, though, from my mom and my dad were that hard work went a long ways. And I got a lot of that along with, you know, it doesn't necessarily happen right away. It's hard work over a long period of time. And so that, you know, I ended up getting my first job when I was 12, and you know, I had summer jobs, and I had after-school jobs, to this day, when I first entered this business, financial planning business, I had a mentor who said, you know, Jonathan, you work harder than no one else for the first 5 years, and then, you know, you can be successful at this, but that's what it takes. And I don't think there's a lot of folks that would say that it doesn't work that way anymore, and I generally don't believe that, because I see it happen all the time. I see people that decide they're going to be painting contractors, or decide they're going to clean carpets, or decide they're going to, you know, be an Uber driver, and they put in the time and effort and energy and work and figure it out and work really hard, and they end up doing really, really well.
Well, with that kind of knowledge going into the game, one would conjure up visions of Brooks Brothers suits and shiny valises walking down Wall Street. But you took a turn toward Buddhism, which most Wall Streeters don't do. How did you manage to get the practice?
So I had there's a big circle involved here, and the circle was, you know, when I was young, 8 or 9 years old, I traded my first stocks. My dad had a broker, and his broker was someone we visited in, you know, downtown Rapid City, South Dakota, a small office, and I would read value line research, and that was funny for me. And so I started my undergrad in finance, and I was really interested in that, and I got bored pretty quickly, and so I started studying philosophy and religious studies, comparative religion. And a couple of my professors said, hey, Jonathan, you obviously like writing, you like to study this stuff, and I did. I had a lot of fun studying it, and they said, you should go on to study in grad school. And I did. I came out to Berkeley, California, and I studied at the Graduate Theological Union. I was working towards a master's in Buddhist phenomenology. So, you know, I had lots of different teachers that were, you know, monastics themselves, and they were teachers, and I had, you know, Qigong teachers, and I had, you know, Theravadan teachers, and I had Tibetan meditation teachers, and we did a lot of Japanese meditation teachers, did a lot of different kinds of meditation, and spent a lot of time sitting as well as the academic study of Buddhism, Abhidharma, all kinds of things like this. And, you know, before I graduated with my master's in Buddhist studies, my first wife said, you know, Jonathan, you've been studying a long time, and it's time for you to go do something that produces income. And so I was like, okay, she wants to study. What am I going to do? I have an unfinished degree, unfinished master's in Buddhist studies, and there isn't really a job for that. So I went back to what I knew prior and got a job at Dean Witter. And it didn't take anything to get a job at Dean Witter. You had to fog a mirror, and you could get a job at Dean Witter. So I started as an advisor, as a broker at Dean Witter, which quickly became Morgan Stanley Dean Witter. And the rest is pretty much history. I left 5 years after the joining Wall Street firms and wearing those, mine weren't Brooks Brothers suits. I didn't have any money. So I you know, Sears off the rack, and, you know, shoes from Payless that looked really good. I did that for about 5 years, and then I finally said, okay, I got to set up my own practice.
Well, you know, I'm always telling friends and anyone who will listen that I think the idea of money goes beyond dollars and cents, and that money is really energy. And I know you understand what I'm saying here. Opening to the flow of money in and out of your life can reduce stress, help you achieve your money goals and such. So when people say they don't have enough money, is it the fear, the energy of fear itself that's being a resistance or a repellent toward their success? Or is it just bad technique?
Wow.
I mean, I think it's kind of a feedback loop. You know, we're afraid we don't have any money, and then the fear is actually pushing money away, you know, more than leaving us receptive toward better money habits.
Yes, and I
don't want to go too far out there, you know what I mean, but I'm I don't know. I believe in the energies, and I think...
Yeah, that, totally.
Yeah.
Totally. I think there's something even deeper than that, though. And I think that in our culture, and I'm in Berkeley, so Berkeley, California, and I have a sense here, about capitalism versus socialism, mm-hmm. right? And we have a general dislike for big business, specifically. We have a general dislike maybe for money in general. And I think that dislike bordering on hatred for money and people with money actually ends up hurting us. I was on a board for a Berkeley Food and Housing Project a long time ago, 22 years ago. And there's a guy that was a Catholic priest, and he said, Jonathan, you know, and we were taking a training on how to raise money for this Berkeley Food and Housing Project for people that were homeless or people that didn't have food to eat, and we're raising money for this Berkeley Food and Housing Project. And he was teaching us how this is, you know, I'm 20-something, 25 at the time, and he's teaching us how we ask for money. And he said, Jonathan, and this stood out in my mind, he said, if you were really good playing soccer or, you know, frisbee or something, I would ask you to coach this kid's team. Jonathan, if you were a really good teacher, I'd ask you to teach a class on something. Jonathan, you're a business person. I want you to write a check. And so that coupled with some of the people that I worked with early on in my career who said they stayed in this business that disagreed with many of the things that they believed in their hearts, but they did it because they wanted to be able to give back to their communities, and they did. They lived that. They wrote big checks. They supported people that needed support. They did scholarship programs. They helped. You know, one of my mentors was a Latino, one of the only ones in the Bay Area that was an advisor named Ernie Guzman. Great guy. He stayed in the business because he could be an example to other kids that looked like him when there were no other examples. And so there's good reasons to work in this industry, besides from just the good work you can do with clients. But we have this general dislike for money that I don't understand where it comes from. I wasn't raised with it. And I think it hurts us. I think it pushes it away. Money goes where money is loved. And if you don't care, or don't, if you hate it, it's not going to come to you. And I think you're absolutely right. I think there's a lot of that that's true.
Our guest on this Chief for Yourself is Jonathan K. Dio, author of Mindful Money, Simple Practices for Reaching Your Financial Goals and Increasing Your Happiness Dividend. Alice Walker wrote The Color Purple, among other titles, and wrote the foreword for this book. And she talks about how she kept coins in a piggy bank when she was a child. And I did the same. Today we don't see piggy banks very much, or very many coins for that matter. What would you say is a good way for kids to regularly save in the same consistent way a lot of us did back in the day?
So piggy banks still exist. Now they have three slots. They've got the spend, they got the save, and they've got the give, mm-hmm. right? And that's, both of my kids have that piggy bank, and there's different processes that people use in terms of helping their kids save, because the one thing that I think is missing is there isn't a, what I had was a passbook savings account. Mm-hmm. Like I would go down and I'd put $10 in, and the guy at the desk would stamp it, and he would write it down as a total, and he'd show me the interest that I've earned on it. And so I had, like, an interaction with a banker as a, you know, 6-year-old, 7-year-old, And that doesn't exist anymore. I took my kids down, we opened up their savings account, but now there's no interest to be had on those kind of savings accounts, so they don't get to see any kind of benefit for, you don't get to see the benefits of deferred gratification. You don't get to see that you made, a nickel, which you see, in a month, you see a penny in a year, which is nothing for a kid. There's no framework for that. So a lot of parents create their own savings accounts and offer their kids 5% interest or whatever, and they end up supporting that interest payment, but it sort of teaches kids the art of saving and the benefits of deferred gratification. And I think my kids get that, but not from the old school methods that we used before. They still like to spend the money, so that's the tool we can use to teach them.
You and I both are based in California in areas that have seen pretty good home price appreciation over the years. When you talk to a client about their finances and their money history and habits really aren't that good, but they really want to buy a house at some point, how do you handle that? A little tough love or cold water to the face? The house thing is something so many people want, but in these parts, that's tough.
Yeah, there's no doubt that that's hard. And for some, it can be a reality, but it's not, it's not going to be necessarily downtown San Francisco or mm-hmm. in Noe Valley in San Francisco or even in Berkeley or even in Oakland. And it's probably not going to be, if it's your first home, you have to save $250,000 for a down payment on a first home in Berkeley. That's a lot. That's a long time to wait. So we talk about alternatives. You buy a condo, you get your foot in the door, you keep making your payments well, you build up equity in that condo, and then 5 years from now you make a transition from that condo into a single family home. Or for us, we've got a lot of people that commute, and BART is our local public transit system, barrier rapid transit. So you can buy a place on a BART line a ways away, and that'll be less expensive, and you can BART into your work or BART into where you need to be every day. And then again, you continue making those payments, and you pay it off a little bit, and then you take the next step up. And by being in the market at all when other real estate prices are going up, your real estate price is going up as well. The difficulty is not being in the market and watching that happen all around you. And do I get in now? When, how do I, people try to wait for a decline, and that's, I don't know that that's happening, because we're not building enough housing to create that possibility. Yeah. Like, there's just not enough homes. So
I want, if you would, to go over the three values that all investors have to embrace that you write about.
And I didn't write these values. These are just working with clients over the years. I come across three different perspectives on the best ways to manage money, the things that matter to each individual. And I've sort of put these three different styles, of investing that have come from clients to me, not that I've prescribed. Working with lots of people over the years, I've discovered that there's these three things. The first thing is there is a desire for performance. And once you talk about the desire for performance, then you get into the social aspects of the desire for performance, and you see a desire for outperformance. Everyone wants to be better than their neighbor, better than their spouse's brother or sister. That's really an important thing to them. And most people do that wrong. Most people seek out performance, and they, through timing and selection, through buying a better stock or through buying it now versus a year from now or a year ago, thinking they can find some kind of a value or some kind of ability to do that. I don't believe in that possibility. So even my search with clients for outperformance comes from an academic perspective. And there are very well-tested, time-honored, evidence-based systems for coming up with some outperformance. And you can find factor-based investing or those kinds of things that will tell people about that. You can get outperformance. It sometimes takes lagging performance in a shorter term to get to outperformance long term. So that's that first way. The second way, and I think this is probably the way that is the leading the charge in terms of public perception, and that's low cost. It is true that if you reduce the costs of your overall portfolio, those reduced costs will go into your pocket. That's a positive. There's always a question about, will it be the same portfolio? Nobody knows. That's not really possible to test. And nobody can say that, hey, my portfolio process is better than your portfolio process. It just, there isn't a way to prove that out over time. So many zigs and zags. The river, you can't step into the same river twice, so it's very difficult to do that. So low cost matters, and that's going to be really important for someone starting out. And then the third, and this is, again, I'm in Berkeley, I believe in this as well, you know, and there's the doctor takes the oath of do no harm. So there are a lot of folks, and this is a very growing element of financial services, and that's, let's be socially responsible to begin with our investments. Now, this isn't, I think this is widely held and more widely held, but I literally yesterday had a meeting with somebody who told me to my face, I don't believe in socially responsible investing. I believe in making as much money as I can and being socially responsible with my activities. And so that's fine. There's enough room of lots of different philosophies. I just don't think that there's a cost to being socially responsible in your investing. And why you would just say no to it, I don't understand, if you don't lose anything by doing it, right? So those are the three. You know, some people want to be really low cost. Some people think it's important to attempt to outperform, and some people really think it's important to be socially responsible with their investments. I think if you have the right process and portfolio design process in place, all three of those are fine. They'll all get you to the same place.
One last quick question. You probably answer in a yes or no. Years ago, I used to watch a show called Wall Street Week with Louis Rukeyser, and Lou used to mention what he called the gold bugs. These guys who would, are buying gold forever and ever. And I'm hearing a lot of talk about that today, too. Is there any place or a good place in a portfolio for buying gold?
So this is actually a more interesting question today than it was, say, 5 years ago. Huh. And the reason it's not a yes or no question anymore, I don't think, is because, Warren Buffett would say don't buy gold. And most really good investors that aren't on the take will say gold doesn't really belong. Some element of commodity might belong in a portfolio, but gold itself isn't even as good at hedging inflation as people say it is. Mm-hmm. But now it's really interesting because now people are talking about cryptocurrency, specifically Bitcoin, as a gold replacement. And I can see, and it's, if you think about cryptocurrency as a commodity, gold we can go mine more of. We can create more gold, find more gold, produce more gold, put more gold into the system so that the value of the gold we have should go down because there's more supply, right? Mm-hmm. So Bitcoin has a similar sense in that we can create more, but there's a limited amount that we can create. So if the world maintains some sort of a dollar value on Bitcoin, Bitcoin's probably more powerful than gold as an inflation hedge because there's a limited supply, and it will always and forever be limited. And so that would probably be a better, if you believed in it at all, that might be better than gold as an inflation hedge. Personally, and I've gone through this so many times with clients and in my own head, I don't believe in Bitcoin or gold as an inflation hedge. Yeah. I believe in innovation and productivity as an inflation hedge. I believe in owning great companies in the United States and the world, and I think that's the best way you can hedge against the rising cost of currency, the rising cost of living. And so when we're building portfolios, we're going to focus on equities and owning shares in the greatest companies in the United States and the world as our method of defending against rising costs. Historically, that's the best way to do it. There's dividends involved. There's potential increase in value of companies because of innovation and productivity, which are all things that culturally, universally, we're trying to improve upon. All the forces that are moving are attempting to support those things. I would go there before I would go to gold or Bitcoin.
Your website, I have websites, actually, dowealthmanagement.com and happinessdividend.com. I'll list both on our webpage, assuming you're going to use both of those.
The book is Mindful Money, Simple Practices for Reaching Your Financial Goals and Increasing Your Happiness Dividend, from our guest, Jonathan K. Dio. Jonathan, thanks for writing this book and melding
money and mindfulness in such a lucid way. Mindfulness is king around here. I don't leave home without it. So if you have some new projects in the works, I hope you'll come back and talk with us again anytime.
Thanks, John.
Quick reminder, subscribe to Genulines at chieforyourself.com. Put your email address into that box at the top of the start page, and you'll get all the show information you need. That is about it for today. Thanks for being here with us and for your likes and follows on social media, too. They're always appreciated. Be well, and I will talk to you soon.